I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 15th of August. Coming up in just a little while, all things political with S.V. Date. He's senior political correspondent at Huffington Post, and we have a lot to talk about. The Clintons released their tax returns for 2015. We will discuss that. It looks like Donald Trump's campaign manager may be in a bit of trouble here. There's $12.7 million in undisclosed cash payments designated for him from the Ukraine's pro-Russian political party from 2007 to 2012. We'll talk more about some of Donald Trump's comments. An interesting article in the New York Times today, the front page, as to progressive Democrats being a little concerned that Hillary Clinton is courting too many Republicans to vote for her in this election. So we'll be talking about all of that in just a moment. But I wanted to start this hour with discussion about what happened in Sherman Park, Milwaukee, over the weekend, which has been making national news. It requires a personal note from me. I lived in Sherman Park for 27 years. We left just 9 months ago. Our family, those many years ago, was choosing a neighborhood that was remarkably diverse with a solid housing stock that was affordable in a segregated city. We were looking for an integrated place to raise our children. We were happy to have made that choice. The children, now grown, were also happy that we made that choice. So the violence of the weekend was something that struck each of us deeply, saddened, disturbed, and yet hopeful that Sherman Park will still rise. So the city is talking about this, of course, today, and we wanted to start our show with two thoughtful people to give us their reflections on what happened over the weekend, what's happening in this neighborhood, what's happening in this city, and what can be done to make things a whole lot better. Saturday, Sherman Park, in the afternoon, a fatal shooting of a 23-year-old armed suspect by a Milwaukee police officer. Both suspect and the officer, African Americans. In the evening, a gas station burned to the ground in Sherman Park. Six other businesses were set on fire. Three were destroyed. There were gunshots throughout the area. Police cars were damaged, objects thrown at police. Four officers were injured. On Sunday, the governor activated the National Guard, and the community gathered to clean up and also to pray. Joining us to talk about this, to start our show this hour, Eric Vaughn. Known Eric for many, many years. And interestingly, we did a lengthy documentary series in 1999, Through One City's Eyes, covering the history of race relations in the city of Milwaukee. Eric and his wife live in Sherman Park. He is the host of the radio program, The Eric Vaughn Show, which airs on WNOV 860 AM from 7 until 9 each weekday. He's a veteran of more than 25 years in the radio industry and has been a fixture in Milwaukee radio and television for a number of years. Eric, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen, for having me. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. Keisha Crum is also with us. Keisha with us about a year ago talking about the Milwaukee Bucks and funding for the Milwaukee Bucks. She's the lead organizer at Common Ground, a nonpartisan organization comprised of 40-plus small businesses, congregations, nonprofits, colleges, and labor unions. They're working on education, foreclosures, and health care. And they are working in the Sherman Park community by targeting various negligent actions of five major banks. Thanks, Keisha. Thank you so much for joining us again. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, very nice to have you here. It seems to me, and let's start with you, Eric, that you've got so many really difficult problems, and they are racial problems in the state of Wisconsin, but particularly in Milwaukee, when you look at unemployment, when you look at education, when you look at role models, et cetera, that a lot of people here were saying when there were other problems in other cities, I'm surprised it has not happened in Milwaukee. And yet, you live in that neighborhood. I lived in that neighborhood for a long, long time. That neighborhood was a vision of something better for everybody, and to have this happen, it just hurts the heart, doesn't it?
It does, Kathleen, but I think it would hurt no matter where something like this were to take place. Obviously, there are a lot of people, including the mayor, who have said things like Sherman Park is this wonderful place that, you know, everybody, I heard a gentleman yesterday say that this is a place that black people aspire to live in.
Mm-hmm.
I think that people aspire to live anywhere where there is peace and calm and where housing is relatively inexpensive. And Sherman Park did offer that. But Sherman Park has also had its problems over the years. I call it my second tour of duty in Sherman Park. The first house I had was at 44th and Townsend. And that was in the mid-1990s. And I left the area then because crime was a problem, because we were going through the cruising stage through Sherman Park when, you know, young people were driving through, playing loud music. There were complaints about people urinating in people's yards and, you know, women, girls dancing on the hoods and roofs of cars. So we've probably forgotten about some of those times, and certainly that doesn't, you know, say it's not equal to the kind of uprising and confusion we had in the city this or in the neighborhood this weekend. But I'm just saying that I think we have, to some degree, romanticized the elegance and beauty of Sherman Park and elevated above other communities, other neighborhoods in this community that have had problems that have been far greater documented.
Mm-hmm. Why did it happen right now in that neighborhood? Why was the response to this shooting? I don't know if people in the neighborhood thought that this suspect was unarmed, or all of the other things that have happened in the city, the bad things when it came to police and the community, they were just waiting for a shooting for people to see, and this would be the response to it. But why was this the response, the burning, the gunshots, the throwing concrete at police officers, et cetera?
I don't know if I have an answer for that. I do know that this morning on my show I had Reggie Moore, the newly appointed head of the Office of Violence Prevention in the city, and he talked about the cumulative effect of incidents that have occurred in Milwaukee to people like those who live in Sherman Park, who live around Sherman Park, maybe being the cause of the level of frustration we saw and the eventual boiling over of those frustrations this weekend. I can't say that the people who did the burning and looting are the same people who were pained by the death of Sylville Smith.
Right.
In fact, his family, his two sisters and his brother, or his two sisters, I definitely heard them say that this isn't about tearing up the neighborhood, that this isn't about acting as people were acting late Saturday night or even earlier Saturday evening when they set the gas station on fire or the parts place later in the night. They certainly were not condoning the bad behavior we saw. They wanted to be there as part of the protest action to raise questions about the shooting of their brother. But in terms of, again, the bad behavior we've seen, I haven't met anyone. I haven't talked to anyone. I haven't heard anybody even talk about the people who may have been responsible for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't heard much about that either. Keisha, what is it that the community can do? It seems to me as though we've got a huge, huge problem here on all kinds of levels. What is it that everybody needs to do so that the neighborhood can be stabilized and so that people can find that their lives can have more meaning than to be burning down gas stations and and throwing bricks and shooting off guns. I mean, all of it is so incredibly disturbing. It's no way we want to live. What do we do?
Well, I can tell you what leaders in Common Ground who live in Sherman Park have done and are doing. We have 8 member organizations in the Sherman Park area, and we have, over the last 4 years, been systematically and consistently working on addressing the housing issue and the safety issue in the neighborhood. So people like Frank Finch III, like Tony Wagner, like Deacon Alex Hardy from Community Baptist, they're committed to relationships and committed to the long work that it takes to really revitalize a community. And so that's been our strategy, and being really clear about that part of what's, you know, I think happened is that there's a lot of rage in this city amongst African American folks because of the realities of lack of jobs, lack of opportunities for mm-hmm. children. The list goes on and on. And when you're faced with that kind of reality and feel like you have no power to affect it, you act out of rage. And I would argue that our folks have acted out of anger. the sense of this deep loss and grief about what was in Sherman Park and what could be, in a very focused and targeted way that has resulted in houses looking different and blocks looking different and bringing back quality of life and a sense of safety and change in that neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would have to disagree with you, Eric, that that vision of Sherman Park, and I'm a white person who lived there, but this vision of having an integrated neighborhood, there haven't been many really integrated neighborhoods in the whole city of Milwaukee for a long period of time, and it was as though people came together, consciously made a decision to think how much better life would be if people, you know, of all different kinds of backgrounds, and then the Orthodox community moved in, so it's black and white and Orthodox and all kinds of different people. It's a very rich environment to raise your family. And to have that vision sort of in a quandary right now, wondering what will happen with the future, is disturbing, because it was a good vision and people were trying to live something out, I think.
I'm not sure where we disagree. You said you disagree with what that I said.
Well, that people had too big a vision of Sherman Park, that it always hasn't been, that it's not this vision of something that's always really good, that there have been problems there.
Well, I'm just saying that, I mean, I don't know that I've stated anything that wasn't actual. I mean, I spent weeks talking about the cruising problem, which was a huge problem
right. In
Sherman Park. The other thing about Sherman Park is that we're talking about a pretty vast area. I mean, there's some parts of the – I'm talking to David Crowley this morning, who is the newly elected member of the state assembly. He said he lives at 51st and Capitol. He said that was Sherman Park. I mean, I live at Sherman and Wright. That's a mile and a half away,
a
mile away from where he is. I don't even think of 51st and Capitol as Sherman Park. So, I mean, I think in that space, you have a wide variety of people, a diverse population of people, both economically, socially, racially. And sometimes these groups don't come together. They may work together on certain projects and at certain times, but there is a clear line of delineation between the groups of people who live in Sherman Park. I live on Sherman Boulevard. I know that if I go two blocks east of my house, there's a different type of population of people who live there than the people who live on Sherman Park. We may look alike, but our social structure is totally different.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reality. That's not a criticism, but that's the reality that we have to face. And saying I live in Sherman Park may mean one thing to some people. It'll mean something else to someone else.
Yeah, I get you. I understand what you're saying. You mentioned, Keisha, the job situation. It seems that this is a real issue in the city of Milwaukee, and a lot of people just don't have a way to make a living, to make meaningful lives for themselves. I thought, as you look at what's happening not only in Milwaukee but in other cities, that somebody needs to look at this problem and say, people need to work. We need to put some resources and really great minds and find out ways to get jobs here. Why don't we do that, Keisha?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That's the issue that could change this whole dynamic, because when you have a job where you can make a living wage, take care of your children, take care of the people you love, have health care, have a pension, you have different opportunities. And when you live in a city and you see a downtown that is booming, you see huge money being put into an arena and nothing in neighborhoods, that creates a lot of rage. And so part of it is that we have to have the imagination about how do we create not 100 jobs, thousands of jobs for the African-American men that want to work in the city. And, you know, and I think for Common Ground, we're not naive to think that we can solve that problem with our Neighborhoods Now campaign, but we think it's a start. And looking at 5 catalytic neighborhood projects that could be local initiatives to put people to work by redoing Washington High School, putting in a rail track and a turf field, and investing in the same kind of work and housing that we've done in Sherman Park and other parts of the city, and building an indoor sports complex on the south side for thousands of kids to play. We think those would be a start to addressing this question around real investments in neighborhoods and people getting real jobs.
Mm-hmm. Eric, how do we need to invest in neighborhoods, which may make things better?
I think some of the things that Keisha named are excellent ideas, excellent starters. But I don't know that. I think that there should be, you know, we hear the mayor talking about Century City all the time, and there's this big absence of enterprise there, and there are opportunities there. I'm wondering why we haven't seen some kind of action to make sure that there is a business there. Now, I know that the city will tell you that they're working hard day and night to get people to move into Century City, and people just aren't going there. I don't understand why not, but we have some places that are, you know, in terms of the infrastructure being there to begin to improve conditions and to provide opportunities for people. For whatever reason, we're not taking advantage of those. And by we, I mean government, private industry, the neighborhoods, and even organizations that might find some energy in the community by advocating for them to do these projects in these areas, again, where the infrastructure already exists. Maybe that's a direction we go in.
Mm-hmm. What is it that is being done now and needs to be done to keep the neighborhood calm? Obviously, you don't want to have this kind of chaos and violence continuing or have the threat of it with you for weeks and weeks and weeks. Eric?
Well, I think one of the things we have to admit that this is unpredictable. It's unpredictable until those things that Keisha just mentioned, jobs and business opportunities, are made available, and people who feel that there is nothing for them in this city change, have their attitudes change, and things are done to change their attitudes. Because, I went to a meeting on Sunday, a community meeting on Sunday, where there was conversation about getting people into the community to kind of help calm things. And really, they were looking for some immediate kinds of reactions from people to indicate that things were better. I just think that until we figure out the long-term strategy, and I think, again, that's connected to jobs and opportunity, educational improvement, all those things that we talk about all the time.
Right.
Until we create a strategy that actually accomplishes that, we are sitting on a powder keg, mm-hmm. or on powder kegs, not only in Sherman Park, but in other areas of the city where nothing yet has erupted.
Yeah. Well, we've had a long time to come up with a long-term strategy, haven't we? We've had years.
Well, and I think that's part of the opportunity and the challenge in this moment, that I agree that the first order is to restore some level of calm, but there also has to be a real vision from our mayor and our common council. Our 2017 budget is going to be voted on in the next few months, and we see that as an opportunity for the mayor and the common council to put some real money back into neighborhoods to show that good faith and that goodwill that neighborhoods like Sherman Park, neighborhoods on the South Side, they matter because we put our money where things matter. And that's what our leaders are going to be pushing for and putting pressure on our mayor and our older people to not just talk about, let's do something for neighborhoods. We're bringing a solution. We're bringing a group of people that want to fight for this and make this happen, because it has to happen for our children and for our neighborhoods.
Let's take one call, and then we'll move to Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Ray in Milwaukee, hi.
Yeah, I'm a habitual caller to our Alderman Nick Kovac on the east side here, and I have suggested to him for probably the last 10 years, it was D'Amato before him, now it's Kovac. You could see the east side getting millions and millions and millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to build light rail here. That's $700 million to a section of the city that, if anything, does not need light rail. Everyone here in east side of Milwaukee is driving their own car or two. And at the same time, the inner city of Milwaukee is disintegrating before our eyes. And I suggested to the alderman several times, I've never gotten a call back from him, by the way, on my suggestion. If a developer wants to develop something on the east side or downtown or in Bayview, fine. But that developer should also have to provide some low-income housing, a playground, a public pool, something in the inner city.
All right, I need to hold you there, Ray. Our time is short. Eric?
Well, I don't know that you can make a developer develop. I mean, I think if you start putting those kinds of constraints on developers, they just find someplace else to spend their money. I'm with him that we need to do more in the central city. But I think that the central city also has to provide has to prove itself worthy of attracting those people who want to invest large sums of money to make conditions better.
Thank you both very much for being with us, Eric and Keisha. Thanks.
Thank you.
Kathleen, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Our pleasure to have you on. Eric Vaughn, now host of the radio program, The Eric Vaughn Show on WNOV, 860 AM here in Milwaukee from 7 to 9 each weekday. Keisha Crum, lead organizer at Common Ground, and there are a number of organizations. They are comprised of a number of organizations working on education, foreclosures, and health care. We'll be back to this topic tomorrow. Milwaukee Police Chief Flynn is scheduled to be with us, and we are also going to talk with somebody who's doing community policing in the Sherman Park area. So that's coming up tomorrow during our first hour of our program tomorrow, I believe. All right, we'll go on to all things political as we continue here and meet our new guest and talk some politics. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All things political now. S.V. Date is joining us, and he is senior political consultant for the Huffington Post. He is the author of 5 novels and 2 political biographies, including one of former Florida Governor Jeb Bush. He's been a journalist for the Associated Press, the Palm Beach Post, National Journal, and for NPR. And we thank you very much, S.V. Date, for being with us. Hi.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Let's start with this story, which is developing. I think it broke over the weekend. This $17.7 million in undisclosed cash payments designated for Trump's campaign chief, Manafort, from the pro-Russian political party for a number of years.
Right. The New York Times report today says it was over like 5 or 6 years from the 2010 timeframe going forward. Now, of course, he was working for the leader at the time, Yanukovych, who was kind of shown the door by the people of Ukraine in 2014, 2015, and then he's been in exile in Russia, I guess, now for the last couple of years. The amount of money is interesting. The fact that it was supposedly cash makes it even more interesting.
Right.
So, yeah, there's a lot to pick through there.
Yeah. Let's talk about Hillary Clinton's tax returns. They made a lot of money last year. I mean, it's an amazing town. They made $10.6 million. Does that force Donald Trump to release his records? Why do you think he hasn't released his records? And what do you think about the Clintons' amount of money? Not as much as they made the year before.
No, but I think Hillary Clinton was starting to run and doing a lot of things that take up the time away from being able to go and make $250,000 speeches, I guess. So part of it is just she had other things going on at the time. Will Donald Trump release them because of this? Probably not. There's a very good reason, and only known to, I think, Donald Trump and maybe those closest to him, why he's not really, what particular thing is in those returns that he doesn't want out. If they were very straightforward and simple and showed that he made a whole lot of money and paid whatever he paid in taxes, I think we would have seen them months ago. The fact that we haven't, well, I think Tim O'Brien, who wrote a biography of Trump that Mr. Trump disliked so much that he sued him for defamation and lost ultimately, he's actually seen the tax returns as part of his the discovery in that lawsuit. And he intimated the other day that, well, there's a number of things that he doesn't want known. One is maybe he doesn't make quite as much money as he claims. Another mm-hmm. is how much he may or may not have given in charity. So, yeah, there's probably a lot of downside potential to those releasing those returns. And Trump probably sees no reason to open himself mm-hmm. for that.
Did he intimate, O'Brien, that is, anything remotely like what David K. Johnston wrote? Well, actually, he said to us last week that he thinks that Donald Trump may never have paid income taxes.
Well, never is a long time. And Tim O'Brien only saw the returns that were at issue prior to that lawsuit and prior to that deposition being taken. So there have been several years, 7 or 8 years since then. So we don't know. He doesn't know either. I don't think he suggested that. And with real estate developers particularly, it's quite easy to end up paying no taxes in a given year because of the very favorable treatment for writing off real estate. And so, you know, it's not unusual. It would look really bad if he's talking about how the system is rigged and so on, if he's one of the people who's been a huge beneficiary of this rigged system.
Mm-hmm. The Wall Street Journal, today's editorial, getting a lot of attention because it's about Donald Trump saying that he's alienated his party. He's not running a competent campaign. They say, I quote, Mrs. Clinton is the second most unpopular presidential nominee in history after Mr. Trump. But rather than reassure voters and try to repair his image, The New Yorker has spent the last 3 weeks giving his critics more ammunition. We can talk about that ammunition. But what does it say when you've got conservative editorial boards like the Wall Street Journal saying he needs to get his act together or get out of the race?
Right. I don't know that the Wall Street Journal has ever been a big supporter of Donald Trump's presidential campaign, so maybe they're not the best folks to be looking at this. To be honest, I don't know if there is a newspaper out there that has supported Donald Trump's president. Maybe the New York Post has, I guess. So I don't know. I don't know if we can take that quite at face value. I'm sure they would have preferred somebody else, anybody else, heading into the primaries and coming out of them. Nonetheless, it does speak volumes that at this point in the race, typically the Wall Street Journal editorial board, typically just about any Republican or right-of-center group is rallying behind the Republican nominee, regardless who that happens to be. We've seen that when John McCain was the nominee. We've seen that when Mitt Romney was the nominee, even though folks weren't crazy about either of them. Instead, we're seeing here the writer saying, look, you're horrible, why don't you step aside? So that's new.
Yeah. And you've been covering all of this at great length for some time now. He keeps doing all these things day after day. The ISIS comment, the Second Amendment comment, just happening one after another. Is anybody telling him to say that? Why is he saying that?
I don't believe anyone is telling him to say that.
Really?
He doesn't, because that's how he is.
Mm-hmm.
An idea comes into his head, and it's out the door before he's had a chance to think about whether it's good or not. That's the way he's been for decades. Just look back at his history. There is no reason to believe that a 70-year-old man is now going to change because some advisors are telling him that this isn't working. He already knew everything. He said this many times. He knows better than the generals. He knows better than these horrible political consultants. He knows better than everybody. So I don't know why he would change. He hasn't done it in decades.
Mm-hmm. And now he's talking about voting. You have written about this, too. I mean, you've written a lot about Donald Trump. This, if I lose Pennsylvania, the only way is because it will be rigged. It'll be fraud. If the disgusting and corrupt media covered me honestly and didn't put false meaning into the words, I'd say I'd be beating Hillary by 20%. He sure isn't beating Hillary by 20%. And the comments about rigged voting, that there's going to be rigged voting, don't trust the election, are coming pretty far before an election. What's that strategy? Where is that going to get him?
Again, you're using the word strategy.
There isn't one.
Describing Donald Trump. And
okay.
I'm not sure that's an appropriate word. But I'll tell you this, this does seem borderline dangerous. What he's doing is suggesting that if he loses, it's because he got cheated.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of folks who are taking him at his word on all kinds of things. I don't know if that's wise, given his history of, his relationship with facts over the many years. But this is amazing that right now, 3 months away from the election, he's saying, I couldn't possibly lose, and if that happens, you guys stole it from me. And at that point, he crosses a line, I think, from, say, having normal speech about your plans, about your opponent's plans, about the system in general, to saying that basically our democracy is non-functional.
Mm-hmm.
and it's illegitimate. Now, that is something that I don't think we've ever heard, and I don't know how appropriate that is for a candidate of any kind.
Mm-hmm. What's the story of the latest on the debates? Is he going to debate? Or are we going to have three debates, more or less?
he'll debate if he thinks it's in his interest to debate. He'll back out or find some excuse not to if he thinks that he will either gain from that or lose less than from having debate. I mean, you know, remember the Republican debates. How many times was Donald Trump able to explain a policy in detail, any policy? And I can't think of one. And those things were like a world wrestling entertainment type of deal with multiple candidates all shouting at each other. I remember one time, actually, they were literally shouting at each other, and the closed captioning said, in an unintelligible yelling was going on at that moment. That's not how it's going to be during the actual general election debates. I mean, there's one moderator, there's a relatively quiet room, and Hillary Clinton is good at this format. I mean, look what she did in the Democratic debates. She did very well. So he knows that he's going to have to learn a whole lot of stuff, which he said just the other day. He actually said this in one of his remarks, I don't study. Well, okay, you've got 1 month before, or in a few days, before you will be expected to know a lot of facts about the world and the government and this country that right now he's not shown any evidence that he knows. So I don't know what he's going to do. But to think that he has to do them just because everyone does, well, everyone's released their tax returns in the past 40 years, too. He hasn't done that.
In Hillary Clinton's strategy, she seems to be trying to get a lot of Republicans to vote for her and is touting Republican support, those who are leaving Republican ranks. Is there a problem in that? Does it turn off progressive voters who have voted for Bernie Sanders who really don't like what she's doing now? Not trying to woo them, but woo the Republicans?
Right. It may turn them off. They may decide, look, the system is rigged. See, she's just going to go out and grab Republicans, too, and either they won't vote at all or they'll vote for Donald Trump. I kind of doubt the latter, but who knows. But if she succeeds and wins a comfortable margin in November with some Republican support, she can say, look, I have a mandate not just to do what I've always wanted to do, but I've got a mandate that everyone else should work together to do this with me.
What's the mandate?
I don't, well, her mandate, if she wins with Republican support, is that, look, we have a consensus here, the consensus of this country, including Republicans, that I should be the president and I should do these things that I said I was going to do. And it'll also give her probably some flexibility to negotiate or to compromise a little bit, whereas if she won solely with just liberal support, that would probably make that a little bit hard for her to do.
Does it mean, though, that she has to govern more moderately?
I don't know if she has to, but it gives her the opportunity to.
Mm-hmm.
And she's always been more of a centrist than President Obama, certainly more than her husband. So I don't know. Looking back in her history, there was a time when she was very idealistic and very liberal, and that changed in the 1990s when they got to the White House and saw that, you know, you take half the loaf or one-third of the loaf rather than getting nothing at all after they learned the hard way with the healthcare initiative. So maybe she'll revert to where she originally was and say, look, these are the things I always wanted to do, and that's how I'm going to do them. I won this election. But, you know, her political history suggests otherwise.
S.V. Dati is our guest now for All Things Political. He's senior political correspondent at the Huffington Post. He's written a biography of Florida Governor Jeb Bush and has worked for the Associated Press, National Journal, NPR, Palm Beach Post. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And we'd love to hear from you. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. Hillary Clinton released the income tax return showing $10.6 million in income, $6 million of that from speaking fees for appearances that were made largely before her campaign was launched in April of 2015. What do you think about that amount of money and the amount of money that they gave to charity? $1,042,000, $1 million going to the Clinton Family Foundation. Do you think that it's very important for Donald Trump to release his tax returns? Do you expect that it will happen? Do you want them to debate? And how many debates would you like to see? And, of course, what do you make of the latest rounds of Trump announcements? Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. Jim in Rice Lake. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Kathleen. I was listening to your guest, and I agree most of what he's saying about Donald Trump, but despite the most, like, disastrous start of a campaign in perhaps modern American political history, he's still only down 8 points. And 67% of the people in this country, you know, for economic reasons, believe the country is going in the wrong direction. And if Hillary Clinton had what is her campaign theme? I want to be president, and it's my turn. And I say this as someone who's not voting for Trump. I'm just concerned that she has no real message other than she wants to be president. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Jim.
Right. Well, it's a hard thing for a candidate from the party of the president who's had 2 terms to come in and offer any type of message, unless it's a pure continuity type of message. This is the position that George Herbert Walker Bush was in 1988 when he ran to succeed President Reagan's 2 terms. And his message basically was, well, I'm going to make conservatism kinder and gentler. Well, what did that mean? The implication was that that what Reagan was doing was not kind or gentle. And kind of the same way she has to say, well, President Obama's done a magnificent job and things would have been a whole lot worse if he hadn't been there, and I'm going to try to improve them. That's kind of the box she's in, just having to run as a Democrat after 2 Democratic terms. On the other hand, Donald Trump has made her job a lot easier. I mean, we had Mayor Bloomberg go up on the stage in the Democratic convention and say, look, we need someone who's sane and competent. Well, Hillary Clinton could just say that. I'm sane, I'm competent, vote for me. And that could probably be enough to get a large plurality, if not a pretty decent majority of this country to vote for.
Oh, my goodness. I was just thinking about what you just said. I'm sane, I'm competent, so people will vote for me for president because I'm sane and competent. Shouldn't those be givens?
Well, you know, everything's relative, isn't it?
Right,
so
yes. Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Jim, very much for your call. Al sends an email. What's the status, do you know, of the lawsuit against Trump University?
There are multiple lawsuits against Trump University. One of them, the most famous one, of course, is with the Indiana judge who's been labeled a Mexican judge by the Republican nominee for president. That's in California. That's ongoing. There's supposed to be, I believe, a decision on whether to release videotaped depositions that Trump had to give. There's an action by the New York State Attorney General that's also against Trump University. I'm not sure what the status of that is. So, and, you know, given that we're only 3 months away from Election Day, I doubt very much we're going to have a final decision on anything in that time period.
Lisa is on the road. Hi, Lisa. Lisa?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Hi, I was just wondering, there doesn't seem to be a lot of discussion in this discussion with third-party candidates. And there was not a lot of talk about, you mentioned that there was, or when the gentleman mentioned that there was the option of Bernie supporters to go to Hillary or to go to Trump. But I've seen so many people going to Jill Stein and Gary Johnson. So I just wanted to see if you could comment on that.
And we have another independent candidate, too. I know you've written about him, SV.
That's right, yeah. Evan McMullen got into the race, I guess it was last week. And to be honest, the one who could have the biggest effect on all of this is Evan McMullen, because he is, he's a member of the Churches of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He went to BYU. I believe he's a Utah native. And folks in Utah are not at all crazy about Donald Trump. Granted, they don't like Hillary Clinton either, but they really dislike Donald Trump. And so he could be someone that conservative voters in Utah, which there are many, could say, look, we'll just cast our vote for him. We haven't besmirched ourselves by voting for Trump, and we haven't done anything we feel is unethical by voting for Hillary Clinton. She could possibly win that state if that happens in large numbers. Also in Arizona, there's a sizable Mormon population in Arizona. That's another state that could swing. Now, in terms of the other candidates, Governor Johnson, Jill Stein, I don't know what realistically they can do. I don't think they can win any state. They could possibly peel off enough votes in some states to affect the outcome. We saw what happened, of course, in Florida in 2000 with Ralph Nader. But, you know, I mean, ultimately we have a constitutional system that kind of favors the two-party system. We don't have a parliamentary republic here. This is, you don't form the government based on how many seats you win. So it's hard for three parties or multiple parties to play in this thing unless, because, you know, in other countries you've got many parties. You also have coalition governments. We don't have that here. So long term, I don't know what to do about that. Short term, I just don't see anyone other than possibly McMullen making a big difference.
Hmm. Let's go next. Thanks, Lisa, very much for your call. Claude in Cudahy. Hi.
Hi. I was just thinking that I could prove that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton didn't have anything to do with the founding of ISIS, because all three of us were on a spaceship somewhere beyond the orbit of Saturn. So they weren't even on the planet.
Well, many people are saying that, yes.
Right. All right. Thanks very much, Claude, for the call. Donna in Hartford. Hi, Donna.
Hi. Donald Trump criticizes President Obama as much as anybody else, but specifically the president for, you know, not being in the office as often as he should be and how often he may be out golfing or on vacation with his family, etc. But if we saw a Trump presidency, how much of Donald Trump's time do you think would be spent doing Donald Trump's business as opposed to doing the business of the United States?
Yeah, well, that's an excellent question. He says that he would turn all that over to his children to run. But there's, I don't think, anything in the Constitution that says that has to happen. I'm not sure how the ethics laws would relate to the actual chief executive, as they do with the hired people in the executive branch. There have been a number of articles written about what would happen to his various enterprises should he actually become president. I don't know the answer. And what he said so far is that, well, my kids would do it and I would have nothing to do with it. Okay, well, we'll take him at his word, I guess, because I don't know if there's any other guidance.
We go to George in Milwaukee next. Hi, George.
Hi. I wonder if a guest might comment on the fact that Hillary was actually rather, got rather high marks from many Republicans during her stay in the Senate, and then her first few years, at least, as Secretary of State. I think that there was a pretty widespread consensus, even among moderate Republicans, that she was pretty good.
Right, and she points that out whenever she's pushed on the question of why are you so unpopular. And granted, this new, relatively new thing with the emails has helped. Has increased her unpopularity, has made people trust her less. But she has a point. When she's not running for an office at that moment, she is quite popular. She left the Secretary of State's job with the highest popularity ratings of her entire public life. And I believe they were north of 60%. So maybe if she wins and is in there for a little while, people will stop hating her for a while. I don't know. I mean, a lot of it is just built in now to the partisan culture that we have, is whoever the other guy is, we're supposed to really, really dislike him. So maybe there's a built-in ceiling as to how popular she could be, how much people will trust her, but maybe not. Again, Donald Trump makes it very easy to seem reasonable and approachable in comparison.
800-486-8655, couple lines open, and time for you to get in before we have to say so long to this hour. Amy in Appleton, hi.
Hi, I just want comments on, I've been in the room with many Republicans having a debate who really do not like Trump. They can't stand him, but they're going to vote for him anyway because they don't want Clinton to pick the Supreme Court justices or change the Second Amendment. They think he's just going to hire good people and not really run the government, you know, hire others to do it. So I'll take my comments off the air. What do you think of that?
All right, Amy, thanks.
Right, yeah, that is actually now the single biggest argument that Donald Trump makes on the stump, is even if you don't like me, you think whatever, you have to vote for me because Supreme Court, and otherwise Hillary Clinton will shape the court for the next decades. Well, I guess if that's the best argument you have, you go with it, and you hit it as often as you can. As to what sort of people he would surround himself with, look at the people he surrounded himself with on the campaign. And are they doing a good job, or are they doing a not such a good job? And even if they were able to do a good job, does Trump let them do that? Those are the key questions here. He's got a lot of opinions, many of them based on very few facts, and he seems to override advice he gets from those that he's chosen to give him advice. Would that change once he's president? Maybe. But I don't know that we have any evidence to suggest that it would. And in fact, all the evidence that we have suggests the opposite.
Mm. SV, you wrote a piece for Huffington Post about what would happen if Trump quits. What would happen if he quits? And do you have any belief that he may quit?
I can't say that I have any reason to think that would happen, except for the novelty of all of this. I mean, we've never had a candidate who kind of on a lark decided that he was going to run for president and no one really expected him to do well, possibly including himself, and ends up being the nominee, who runs the campaign the way he does, who now is getting angrier and more sullen by the day based on how it's going. So I don't know what he's going to do in a month. I mean, if his numbers drop below 30%, I have no idea. I don't know that we've ever had a candidate where that happened in recent memory. So will he quit? Beats me. Probably not, but there is a process for the Republicans to pick another nominee. They have to hold a meeting and choose someone. It's all in the hands of the 168 members of the Republican National Committee. They vote by state. Each state delegation, each group of RNC members have the number of votes that they would have had at the convention. In other words, Texas would have a great number of votes, California would, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know that they're preparing for that. I don't know what they're thinking right now because they're not at all pleased with how things are running. I think most of them resign themselves to the idea they're going to lose badly and hope to hang on to the Senate.
Hmm. Ed in Toma, hi.
Hello, am I on the air?
Yes, Ed.
Yeah, well, I heard the other day Jill Stein talking, and I would vote for her. I liked her ideas best, but a gentleman called in and said that he's would vote for her as well, but he's going to vote for Hillary Clinton, and because he's seen him before when Ralph Nader ran, and Jill Stein said, yeah, that's the politics of fear. Well, I have a better idea of how to vote, and that would be that you have a first choice and a second choice. Your first choice, I would vote for Jill Stein. She would get one vote. My second choice would be Hillary Clinton. She gets three-quarters of a vote.
Mm-hmm.
So in four votes, Jill Stein would have four votes, and four votes, Hillary Clinton would have three votes.
SV, what do you think of that?
Well, I think that's interesting. I think you'd have to change a whole lot of laws in order
right.
to get there. And, you know, good luck with that. I don't think that's happening anytime soon, mm-hmm. unfortunately, if that's what you want.
So who takes votes away from whom? She takes votes away from Hillary, and Johnson takes votes away from Trump?
I think she pretty clear, Jill Stein, clearly takes votes away from Hillary. I think Gary Johnson's support is coming from both candidates, some who are just fed up with everything, and there's a very big pro-marijuana contingent among young voters that for some reason think that's the only thing they care
right.
about, and they're going to vote for that, and Gary Johnson's good with that, so that's a little less clear. I think there's a significant percentage of his support that's coming from Clinton.
Yeah. Thank you so much, SV, for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, our pleasure. S.V. Dottie, senior political correspondent at the Huffington Post. He also worked for the Associated Press for a long time and for NPR and other places. We thank him, and thanks to KP Whaley and Scotty Myers for producing this hour. Just a reminder, tomorrow we're dealing with really violence and a whole host of issues that have been present for a long time but maybe haven't received the attention that they needed to receive to keep riots from erupting. But we're talking about what happened over the weekend in Sherman Park with Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn and community policing. That's tomorrow during this 1 o'clock hour. Thanks for listening. We have news coming up. We'll return.